The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Larkin, Judge Smith, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you very much and good morning. Our first case is 821-1338 Maslowski versus Prospect Funding Partners et al. As all parties are aware, we are doing a Zoom argument as we slowly transition back to live arguments. We are recording this, however, our rules prohibit anyone else recording it, either an attorney, a client, or someone who's just watching. So please remember that the audio recording will be available tomorrow. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. It's my understanding the respondents, Mr. Barber, will have 12 minutes and I hope I pronounced this right, Ms. Kuhl, will have 3 minutes. And then finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Whenever you're ready, just begin by telling us who you are in a loud, clear voice. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I am Daniel Beckman, representing the appellant, Prospect Funding Holdings, NY, LLC. We are in front of the court this morning seeking a reversal of the district court's ruling holding that a portion of the contract between Prospect Funding and Ms. Maslowski is unconscionable. We are also seeking a reversal of the district court's dismissal of Prospect's third-party complaint against Mr. Schwabel and the Schwabel, Getz, and Sieben law firm. This case was previously up to the Minnesota Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court abolished the doctrine of champerty. Contrary to the district court and Ms. Maslowski's arguments in this case, the Supreme Court did not specifically direct that the district court scrutinize this contract for equitable purposes. Rather, the Supreme Court simply acknowledged that with the doctrine of champerty abolished, the normal contractual defenses and arguments were still available. The Supreme Court said that the district court may scrutinize litigation financing agreements and that parties like Maslowski retain the common law defense of unconscionability. There was no direction from the Supreme Court that the contract was unconscionable or that it was unenforceable for equitable purposes.
So just so I understand how this all works, there at issue is both the repurchase price, which is the take that the funder would get on a successful either settlement or I suppose jury verdict or verdict or something, right?
Yes.
Okay. And that has a certain schedule, et cetera, and caps off at some amount. And then there's also what I guess you would call, what do you call them? Liquidated. I want to use the term that you use, liquidated damages or penalties provision or what have you. What do you prefer for my question? How do you characterize? Okay.
Either, Your Honor.
Okay. And the penalty provision. So I think one of your complaints, as I understand it, is that the district court shouldn't have considered the penalty provision because it was not being sought here, the penalties. I want to understand in the usual case, if someone doesn't, or in a case like this, if someone doesn't pay the payout, the repurchase, is that a breach that on top of it could add, you could also seek the penalties? So you could seek enforcement and recovery of both the repurchase amount plus the penalty provision.
The way the contract is drafted, that is correct, Your Honor. There are provisions in the contract that say that if you do not pay the amount back when you're supposed to, there is a penalty. In this case, my client has not sought to enforce those clauses, but is simply seeking repayment of the contract purchase amount as set forth in the contract.
And the only penalty, the only breach of the contract for which a penalty would be available to you would be the non-payment. That's the only factual issue. In other words, there wasn't like a failure to notify, or maybe there was. Maybe there are multiple things that you think the penalty provision would apply to.
I'm not aware of any other provisions in the contract other than the failure to pay that potentially is at issue in this case. My client was in communication with the Schwabel firm during the course of the pendency of the underlying litigation and was aware of the fact that the underlying litigation settled and was resolved. Not to get too far into the weeds on the procedural history, but both parties commenced an action. My client commenced an action in New York and Ms. Maslowski here in Minnesota. And the subject of the first appeal was where the case should be heard, and it's here in Minnesota. But the point
and
is-
So for each of the, if another party, another case had multiple violations, like didn't inform, you know, in your view, would the penalty provision provide, relate to each of those? In other words, could you seek 14,850 for each of them?
I don't think so. No.
So regardless of the number of breaches?
It would just be one penalty for failure to pay and or failure for whatever the reason would be.
And I guess my question is, if there were multiple breaches, failure to pay, failure to give notice of a new law firm, failure in another case, does the penalty provision apply to each of those such that someone could rack up a lot of penalties in addition to the repurchase price?
No, Your Honor, the purpose of the penalty provision, as evidenced by the procedural history in this case, is if the person selling their interest in the contract in the underlying action does not pay, then it's incumbent upon Prospect to go out and force it. And while the court in this case determined that the forfeiture penalty was unreasonable because of its comparison to the contract amount, in other words, that a $14,000 penalty in comparison to a $6,000 contract purchase price was unreasonable because of the proportionality, Prospect would argue that $14,000 is a drop in the bucket compared to the damages it's incurred for having to pursue litigation. For example, you know, mechanic lien cases, if you're successful in pursuing a mechanic lien in the amount of $6,000 or $8,000, that doesn't prevent you from recovering attorney's fees and multiple times what the amount at issue is.
Well, actually, having done mechanics liens, you know, by statute, it's reasonable attorney's fees, and the case law indicates it has to bear some relationship to the lien. But apart from all that, I don't want to get into a debate about mechanics liens. So I want to understand, Mr. Beckman, is your claim against the Swable firm then sort of independent of this agreement?
No, the claim against the Schwabel firm is dependent upon the representations that Mr. Schwabel made in the contract, which was to hold the money that was recovered in the underlying litigation until there was resolution of the issues with Prospect.
So since they're theoretically under your idea part of the contract, could you enforce the liquidated damages clause against them?
No, the clause or the claim against the Schwabel firm is that they did not hold the funds. So now that if my client recovers against Ms. Maslowski, the $24,000 that we're seeking, and the Schwabel firm distributed the $70,000, so there's only $12,000 left in its trust account, that there's no recovery for my client, and it's lost the benefit of its bargain because it then has to go out and chase down Ms. Maslowski to try to find those additional funds. So the claim against the Schwabel firm is limited and may never come to fruition. If there was a judgment against Ms. Maslowski for $24,000 and she pays it, there is no claim against the Schwabel firm. But if there's a judgment against Ms. Maslowski for $24,000 and the Schwabel firm has $12,000 or $14,000 in its trust account, and Ms. Maslowski doesn't pay the remaining balance, and that money would have been there had the Schwabel firm done what they said they were going to do, which was to hold the money, then whatever that difference is would be the amount of the claim against the Schwabel firm. So that's the breach of contract we're seeking to.
And then I just wanted to shift briefly, and then I won't interrupt you anymore. I realize you have a lot of issues, and only if, you know, under the attorney's fees provision in the agreement, would you agree that the determination of prevailing party is up to the trial court?
Yes.
Then it's all yours.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to comment briefly on the primary unconscionability argument. The trial court, district court, concluded that the case that we cited did not set forth the standard of unconscionability because it dealt with a termination clause. The reference to that case, however, wasn't particular to the termination clause, but rather to the standard of unconscionability, which is if a contract is unconscionable, if it is such as no person in their senses and none under delusion would make on one hand, and no honest and fair man would accept on the other. In this case, and it was significant to the Supreme Court when the oral arguments were there and they were considering whether or not this contract was enforceable, Prospect requires the selling party to have an attorney. They require the attorney to explain the terms of the contract and to certify that they have done that. Mr. Schwabel, in this case, reviewed this contract with Ms. Maslowski before she signed it. He certified that he explained all the terms to her. There are literally thousands and thousands of people that are entering into virtually identical contracts to this throughout the country. That was recognized by the Minnesota Supreme Court in its decision. This simply is not the type of contract that is unconscionable because no person in their senses and not under delusion would make it.
So, you know, this is all a little, this last argument is a little new to me. Does the record indicate that Ms. Maslowski said, yep, I understand it all, and 60% seems like a lot, but then again, maybe not? Does the record indicate that?
The record indicates that Mr. Schwabel certified and acknowledged that he explained the contractual terms to his client. That's okay. What the record, you know, this, Your Honor.
No, I get it. I mean, you know, in all fairness, that's a very careful answer, and I appreciate that. Well, but that's, you know, I get it. She consulted an attorney. I get it. And that, you know, is one of the issues, whether it's an uncounseled litigant or not. You are correct.
Right. Well, and it's a significant point from this standpoint, Your Honor. This is the third time this case is at the Court of Appeals. We have not had any evidentiary hearing in this case. There has been no trial. There has been very little discovery. And if the court will look at the record, one of the issues that we brought to the court on these cross motions for summary judgment was to say, if you're going to go down this road and have these equitable considerations, we need Prospect needs the opportunity to go out and do discovery to delve into some of the issues that the court just raised. That has never been done in this court. The district court has three times made decisions based on motions on the pleadings and summary judgment without any sort of evidentiary hearing. So the whole—
But I mean, now this is also sort of new to me. I mean, you both moved for summary judgment, correct?
We did, Your Honor.
Okay, so, you know, in all fairness to the district court, you know, if you didn't want to move for summary judgment or argue that there were fact issues in dispute, you could argue that. And I speaking for myself and not my treasured colleagues, I think the whole argument about discovery has sailed. But again, I won't interrupt again.
Well, we made the argument in the alternative, and it's clear, and I think both parties agree, that the issue of unconscionability is a legal determination for the court to make in interpreting a contract. We do not dispute that.
Mr. Beckman, may I ask you, does the I'll just call the person the plaintiff in this situation have the ability and the right to settle the case even against counsel's advice without it being any breach of the agreement with you?
Yes.
Okay. Please. So even if it looks like a terrible, it settles for $3,000, you get nothing then. Well, I guess you would get the $3,000 because you get back up to something, but they could choose independently to settle however they wish.
They can. And in the case where, you know, if there were $3,000 and the attorney gets paid, the Schwabel firm gets paid first, any expenses would get reimbursed. And if there was no money left over, then my client would not receive any payment. That's the way the contract reads. And that's significant for the usury issue because it's contingent. There is no definite obligation to repay Prospect. If there is no recovery, the lawsuit goes forward, she's unsuccessful at trial, or she makes a settlement in her reasonable opinion that she wants to make, and there's no proceeds left over to pay Prospect doesn't get any money, which is why the prospect repurchase rate is such a high rate because of the risky nature of this whole prospect. But the fact that it is contingent is why usury doesn't apply. And Ms. Maslowski makes the argument that there's a distinction between a common law usury argument and a statutory usury argument, and that the contingent aspect only applies to statutory or common law usury arguments, which is simply not the case. All the usury decisions and rely upon the statute, usury statute, which has been around since prior to the 1900. The rate was changed from 6% to 8%, but the language in the statute itself is virtually identical. And the Minnesota Supreme Court has repeatedly indicated that in order for a usury argument to be valid, there has to be an absolute obligation to repay, which was not the case here. And I see my time is just about up, and so I will rest there. Thank you.
I will give you a heads up, Mr. Beckman, on rebuttal. I would like some information provided as to if we agreed with the district court, when should the 8% interest rate commence, either the date of the contract or, as she ruled, from the date of the Supreme Court ruling. So, but with that, we'll hear for the first counsel for the respondent, Mr. Barber. And then, yeah, go ahead, sir.
May it please the court and counsel. Good morning. My name is Matt Barber. I'm the attorney for the respondent, Pamela Maslowski. As the court's aware, this court is reviewing two decisions from the Hennepin County District Court. The first is an equitable determination that some parts of Prospect's contract are unconscionable and therefore not enforceable, but other parts of Prospect's contract are enforceable. They are valid. And the district court ultimately determined, after weighing the equities, that it would be fair for Prospect to be repaid and that Prospect would be repaid with 8% interest. The second issue is the prevailing party issue. The district court took a pragmatic view of who prepared or who prevailed, who lost over the whole course of this litigation, which has been going on for 6 or 7 years now. The district court decided that some parties prevailed on some issues, other parties lost on other issues, and ultimately determined that no party prevailed outright. And therefore, it used its discretion to hold that no party was a prevailing party and denied Prospect's request for attorney's fees under the prevailing party provision of its contract. I'll start with the equitable decision, the unconscionability decision. The district court correctly looked at the totality of the circumstances here. It looked at all of the terms of Prospect's contract, and it also looked at the circumstances of each party at the time they entered into this contract. And Ms. Maslowski is not without blame here. She is not completely innocent. She did sign this contract, which in its essence agrees that Prospect will give her some money and she will pay them back. But she was vulnerable at the time of this. At the time
she will pay them back only if she gets some money.
Correct.
If she, right? I mean, I'm not really understanding the loan or forbearance analogy and why it would be limited to the interest rate would be limited to that which where there is an obligation to repay, when clearly there's a risk here that Prospect takes that they will not get anything after having laid out cash to someone.
The district court, Your Honor, did a really good job addressing the risk that Prospect claims it has here. The risk that the district court points out, the main risk that Prospect had was that the Minnesota Supreme Court would not reverse its precedent about champerty, because the terms of Prospect's contract and its underwriting ultimately assure that it will get repaid. Ms. Maslowski would be penalized $15,000 roughly plus attorney's fees if she decided she didn't want to pursue her case anymore, if she decided she wanted to terminate her representation and not hire new attorneys. The district court points out that it was—
So you could get, if she decided not to pursue the case, that would be a breach that the liquidated damages would apply to, you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. If she terminated counsel and did not appoint replacement counsel and require the replacement counsel to sign the attorney acknowledgement, that is a breach that triggers these penalty clauses, which include attorney's fees as well.
And that didn't happen here, right? I mean, there was, but if a person doesn't, if they take their case and don't end up with a settlement because the other side doesn't settle or they lose at trial, there's no obligation to repay anything, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So why wouldn't that be a risk that's different from lending someone money? That the party that gives the cash to someone is assuming a greater risk. How do we measure what's unconscionable to account for that risk?
And John, the district court again points out that Prospect was almost certainly going to get paid back. Most cases most cases that are in litigation do settle. The vast majority of them settle. And Prospect's underwriting goes to cases that it believes have a high success rate. It wouldn't enter into one of these agreements with a party or with one of its clients that it thought wasn't going to prevail.
Right. I presume that they think they will get, and that affects their terms of what they'll do. I don't know if the terms are identical for every party or not, but it's a risk they take because they can't control what a jury will do, and they can't control what a defendant will do in terms of settlement. I mean, there must be times, I have to guess, where they get zeroed out. That just happens in litigation.
I would imagine that does happen, Your Honor, but we can take a step back about this forbearance and requirement that they ultimately be repaid no matter what, because Prospect points to a case in its reply brief, a case that's called Bangs, and it has the proposition that, there can't be usury unless you have a loan or forbearance. And that quote doesn't actually appear in the Bangs case. That quote appears in a case called Dunn versus Midland Loan Finance Corporation. That's 289 Northwest 411. And at page 413 of that decision, the Minnesota Supreme Court has that quote: there can be no usury unless the transaction involves a loan or a forbearance of money. But the very next sentence is critical. The next sentence provides, a sale of personal property, which is what we have here, is not a loan or forbearance of money and is not within the usury law unless the sale is a mere form or device to evade the usury law. And that's precisely what Prospect is doing with its contract.
Let's separate those for, and I do want to hear why that is. So let's just take out the penalties for a second. Pretend that the contract doesn't include that. I want to focus just on the repurchase. Are you arguing that the repurchase, in other words, the deal for the repayment, should there be success, with zero if there's no success, that would be an unconscionable contract and has to be capped at an 8% return?
Not that by itself, but it's the totality of these circumstances, Your Honor. It's all of the penalty clauses. It's the extremely high interest rate. It's the fact that Ms. Mislowski was injured and was concerned about paying her rent, paying her bills. It's the totality of these circumstances.
What if the record indicated, what I was hinting is, okay, so she's gotten a lawyer, she's been counseled, and what if the record indicated, that is kind of high, but I need the money and I get it. And I'm entering into this fully and completely aware. Does that not undercut your unconscious? I mean, one of the factors is it's an uncounseled client and, she's stressed out, et cetera, et cetera. But what if it's some, former CEO of, who's fallen on hard times and, enters into contracts every day and is sophisticated. And, the record indicates he knows what he's doing or she knows what she's doing. I mean, what's so unconscionable about that?
Your Honor, it's important to take a look at what the law was at the time this contract was entered into. And at the time it was entered into, this contract was not enforceable. 3 weeks before it was entered into, the Hennepin County District Court in a case called Williams decided a nearly identical contract from Prospect was not enforceable. So a counseled person at the time that this was signed has a very reasonable expectation that this is not going to be enforced because it's chamfered. Williams decided it 3 weeks before this was decided. The district court.
So that argument means that that person would have been free to take the money knowing that they will never have a repayment obligation? That seems a little, that argues in favor of a certain savviness that doesn't seem like a poor, uncounseled person.
Well, Your Honor, Prospect Funding knew what it was doing. It knew its contracts were not enforceable and kept making these loans too. So it goes both ways there. It knows its contract is unenforceable and it keeps entering into these contracts with individuals hoping that they don't know what the law of champerty
is. Well, why isn't it then a plague on both those parties? The company and then the sophisticated CEO who also gets it. And everyone's trying to just get everything they can and give nothing. I mean, do we really want to apply unconscionability then?
Again, unconscionability is an equitable remedy, Your Honor. So we'd look at the totality of the circumstances.
Well, I'm saying they both have unclean hands. They both should lose. So let's just enforce. I mean, they both are horrible people. So you know what? They deserve each other. We'll enforce the contract. What's wrong with that?
Under our circumstances or the hypothetical about?
Under my circumstances.
And again, was this before the law of champerty was changed or was it after? Because those are important things for
both.
Our consideration, Your Honor. So starting with before the law of champerty changed, then we would have the same result as the district court here because the corporation keeps entering into these contracts that it knows are not enforceable. So it shouldn't be able to enforce them. Afterward, it would be a different analysis. The equities might shake out differently, but it is still an equitable determination. And the district court weighed the equities that were before it, and it came to a fair result. Prospect does get to be repaid, and it does get a fair amount of interest back. I just want to turn back to the Dunn case and the Bangs case. Again, Dunn explains that we don't have to worry about the strict requirements of a loan or forbearance if the sale is a mere device to evade the usury law. And then we go back to the Bangs case, and on page 185 of its decision, it explains that in order to inquire into the real nature of any transaction, the law will look behind every device or shift used in an effort to defeat the usury statute. That is what Prospect is doing. That is its business model. It characterizes its agreement in such a way to bob and weave, or at least attempt to bob and weave around the usury statute. Even if this isn't technically a forbearance, the district court did what the parties asked it to do and what the Minnesota Supreme Court said it was allowed to do.
Sorry to interrupt you again, but I just have to get back to that usury. I mean, the district court didn't order any penalties, right? It's all about the repurchase.
Correct.
So you do seem to be saying, I know that you said to me, and I understand why, we got to look at the whole, et cetera, but your usury argument is limited to the repurchase price.
I don't know that I understand Your Honor's question, and I want to give you a good answer.
Oh, thank you. Okay, well, the usury argument is that the repurchase schedule is usurious. It doesn't have to do with the penalties, right? Because the penalties weren't actually ordered here. What was ordered is the repurchase, right?
So the 60% interest.
Exactly. So I'm asking you, if we just focus on that provision, are you essentially arguing that in a counseled case like this, that amount cannot exceed 8% without it being an unconscionable contract?
I think it depends on the equities of each case. So depending on how savvy the parties are to this contract, the amount that's fair for repayment could shift. But we don't have, like, to use an analogy about credit cards, we don't have a statute that sets an interest rate cap for these types of agreements. So we're kind of out in common law with no guidance really, except for an analogy to the usury statute, which applies the most broad. It applies to forbearances, it applies to loans, it applies to things in interest. So the district court looked at that and said, you know, it would be fair to deem this contract a forbearance, even if it doesn't technically meet all of those requirements. This is the statute that would apply most broadly. 8% seems like a fair amount under the circumstances. And we're just asking that the district court be affirmed on that part. I see my time's expired.
Thank you. We'll now hear for counsel for the other respondent, please.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michelle Keel, and I represent the respondents James Schwabel and Schwabel, Getz, and Sieben. The only claim in this appeal against the Schwabel defendants is for breach of contract, and that claim fails first and foremost because the plain language of the relevant documents do not create a contract between Prospect Holdings and Schwabel. Now, appellant has shifted its theory several times as to what exactly the supposed contract is, but none of the theories actually create a contract. So it can't be the sale and repurchase agreement because the plain language there says the parties are Maslowski and Holdings. can't be the letter of direction because the plain language is there says it's from Meslowski to Schwebel. It can't be an assignment or a delegation because the sale and repurchase agreement prohibits assignments. And now on appeal, they argue that it could be a third party beneficiary of the letter of direction. But that argument fails as well because there are very limited circumstances under Minnesota law in which a third party can claim to be a beneficiary of an attorney-client relationship. And those circumstances are not present here. That would create the sort of conflict of interest that the case law prohibits. In addition, the breach of contract claim against the Schwebel defendants fails because there is no consideration for Schwebel. Appellant's claim is based on speculation that they may have received a higher contingency fee award based on the speculation that Meslowski received a higher settlement because of the funding. But again, this is purely speculation, and it also contradicts appellant's argument in the previous appeals, both to this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court, in which they argued that the funding had no effect on Maslowski's settlement amount or decision. And so any argument that that creates consideration sufficient to form a contract with Schwebel has no merit. So unless there are any questions from the court, for those reasons, we would ask that the decision below be affirmed.
I guess my only question is, so, and I should know this, I'm sorry that I don't. So was there, do we know there was a settlement in this amount and it came into the firm and it was either firm kept some and then paid out some to Ms. Maslowski?
I believe that is in the record. There's the amount that is in the trust fund. I believe it's in the record. I'm sorry, I don't know exactly
okay.
where.
So if, for example, if I may, Judge Connolly, just one more second. If for example, we were to reverse with respect to Ms. Meslowski such that, or somehow, well, let's, no matter what it is, if she's on the hook for something and let's say reverse on some, so she's on the hook for more, the firm, even though it paid out to her and didn't do what it was, you know, didn't send it to the prospect, et cetera, this would be her problem, not Schwebel's.
Correct. According to the plain language of the documents, that would be Maslowski's obligation, not Schwebel's.
So then she'd just sue Schwebel, and this could go on forever.
Well,
you don't have to answer that. That was a commentary, okay. Ms. Keel. Thank you very much. Thank you. Mr. Beckman, you'll have the last words, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, to address the issue raised by the court that requested be addressed on rebuttal, the timing of when the obligation to repay commences. Two comments, Your Honor. First of all, at page 11 of our brief, we cited the Hoban case with language indicating that the Supreme Court decision essentially renders all the prior other decisions null and void, and we go back. But particular to this case, the conclusion of the district court that somehow Prospect knew, and the argument by Maslowski that somehow Prospect understood that its contract was unenforceable, is simply incorrect. And the record will document that immediately from the commencement of this litigation, Prospect argued that the contract was not champerteous and was enforceable. The only basis that the district court and Maslowski suggest that this would have been, that somehow they should have known, is another Hennepin County District Court decision that was not binding in a precedential fashion on Prospect funding. Prospect believed that its contract was enforceable, brought a claim in New York and defended this claim, arguing right from the commencement that the contract was enforceable, was not champerteous, and believed that. The Supreme Court ultimately, in a very short and not significantly analytical fashion, says yeah, the contract was champerty, but it doesn't really matter because we're going to abolish champerty anyway, and this is why, and therefore the contract's enforceable and you should go back. The court at that point didn't say it's only enforceable now because of our decision. It, as all Supreme Court decisions do, have precedential value, and at that point, the contract became enforceable from its inception.
Right, and here's my, I mean, I have looked at Hoven, and, you know, after the language you quote in your brief, it then goes on to say, you know, it's the law of the decision of a court overruling a former decision is retrospective, and then accept that where a constitution or statute has received a given construction of the court by last resort and contracts have been made and rights required in accordance therewith, such contracts may not be invalidated nor vested rights acquired under them impaired by a change of construction made by a subsequent decision. So my question is, you know, your case addressing retroactively, but not the enforcement of interest provision in the contract during the time the Supreme Court says it was enforceable. And the Supreme Court said this contract may be enforceable if not deemed unconscionable. But the Supreme Court also said it wasn't enforceable under Minnesota law before June 30th, 2020. So if they said that, I'm hard-pressed to see how the district court blew it. And, you know, we should make this 8% interest, and I agree, you don't think that's, you know, shouldn't be 8%, retroactive to the date of the contract. So why am I wrong?
Well, because the Supreme Court decision that says that it wasn't enforceable prior to that time was based on the doctrine of champerty, which it abolished. And so once champerty goes away, the contract then becomes enforceable. If somebody else had another contract that was potentially champerty that was entered into prior to the Supreme Court decision, that contract is still enforceable because the Supreme Court has said we're not going to have champerty in Minnesota anymore. The discussion in Hoven, I think, deals with the issue where there's some sort of contract that's entered into that was completely unenforceable, and then the legislator or somebody comes in and says, we're going to change the law. That doesn't retroactively go back and enforce the contract that wasn't enforceable. This is a different situation because of the nature of the doctrine of champerty.
Mr. Beckman, may I ask you just to, with respect to the Schwebel firm, your client doesn't contract with law firms. I mean, there could be a three-way contract with a law firm, but you choose not to. And perhaps choose not to because that might start to implicate problems with the enforceability of the contract. But isn't that just a risk you run? I understand that you want it to be that way, that it goes to a trust fund, that you have a requirement of an irrevocable letter of direction, et cetera. But you know, if you don't include that party in a contract, I'm not really understanding why you claim to have a contract with them.
Your Honor, the district court's interpretation of the contract saying that Schwebel isn't a party basically renders all the discussion of Schwebel's certification and his discussion and his agreement to honor the direction meaningless. And the construction of a contract says that the court necessarily has to try to construe meaning to all terms of the contract. To say that I mean, the argument is that Schwebel already had this obligation to Ms. Maslowski and it doesn't add anything. Well, then why put it in the contract? There has to be a reason that that's in the contract. And given this limited circumstance where the reason is that the money should be held and that Prospect is relying upon Schwebel's certification that he will hold the money and it will be there to be paid to them if there's a successful recovery, is what gives meaning to that purpose. And otherwise, there would be no reason to have it in the contract. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Beckman. Thank you, Ms. Keel. Thank you, Mr. Barber. The matter is submitted. We will issue our decision within 90 days.